Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Paul Rose, and he'll be answering your most important questions about cruising for carp. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Paul a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your questions. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of the show cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Paul Rose about cruising for carp. I wonder if you guys have heard about the contest we're running now through the end of June. Well, if you haven't, you're hearing about it now. We have three great prizes for you. First, second, third place. First place prize is a pair of Adams Built, the Guide Weld Wader. Retail price on these is $319.95. Second place prize is a Steve Rajeff Echo Edge 590 four-piece fly rod, 9 foot, 5 weight. And the retail price on that is $229.99. And third place prize is a pair of Corker Metal Head Boots, retail price of $159.99. Those are three excellent prizes that we have for you folks. And to get more details on the prizes and how to participate in our contest this month, just click on the banner on the top of our homepage, and that'll take you to the page that describes the prizes and how to get involved. Now, here's the basics. All you have to do is refer your friends, relatives, or customers to askaboutflyfishing.com, and the three people that have the most referrals win the top three prizes. And what constitutes a referral is for them to sign up for our announcements, which is free to them. And if they sign up to receive our announcements, that's a referral. Now, before you go run off and start referring people, you need to become one of our affiliates so that we can track your referrals. It doesn't cost you anything to become an affiliate. In fact, you can even make some money at it, even if you don't win. So find out more about it on our contest page. Again, the banner at the top of the page. Where you can get more details on the prizes and read through the instructions there, get signed up, and start sending people to our site with your personal affiliate link, and you may win one of these prizes. Who knows? Might only take 5, 10, 20, who knows how many referrals to win those prizes. So give it a shot no matter how many people you send, and we'll see what happens. Well, before we introduce Paul, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. In our drawing tonight, we're going to be giving away a 1 year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1 year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Paul's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a $20 gift certificate for Front Range Anglers out of Boulder, Colorado, and their website is frontrangeanglers.com. And if you win the certificate, you'll be able to redeem that either in the shop or on their online store. So no matter where you are, you can take advantage of this. So here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And the question will be about something that Paul and I talk about during the show. You have to submit your answer along with your name and your location in the text box on our homepage. So use your best typing skills and listen carefully, take notes, and maybe you'll win that $20 gift certificate at the end of the show. Well, tonight, our guest is Paul Rose. Captain Paul Rose has been fly fishing for over 30 years. He grew up pursuing trout on the famed waters of the western and central Pennsylvania, then chased everything salt while residing in Texas. He currently lives in Charlotte, North Carolina, operating and guiding for CarolinaBoneFishing.com and has been for 10 years. Best known for introducing anglers to the challenges of sight fishing for tailing carp before it was even hip, these backyard bonefish trips are the basis for his saltwater training schools. He also offers trips for bass, redfish, and has access to 12 miles of private trout water. He has a wealth of knowledge in guiding cold water, warm water, and saltwater species. Paul is an accomplished outdoor writer, photographer, and member of the Southeast Press Association. He has published in Mid-Atlantic Fly Fishing Guide, Eastern Fly, Fur Fish, and Game, North Carolina, South Carolina Sportsman, and a contributor for Pilot Media Waterfront Guides, along with a multitude of Internet venues. Paul is a contributing editor for Fly Fish Magazine and an ambassador to European anglers on flyfishingpoint.com. He's also been featured on Carolina Outdoor Journal TV. Paul proudly supports the Federal Fly Fishers and is a board member of the Southeast Council. He is a certified casting instructor, and currently Paul is working on his first book, Carp on the Fly. He's also a staff member of SAGE, TFO, Ross, Smith Optics, Umpqua, Rainey's, Rio, Sims, and Hell's Bay Boatworks. Paul is also a dealer for Andy's Drifters and destination travel to Argentina. Well, Paul, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Well, thank you, Roger. Thank you very much for having me. I've been a long-time listener, so I was excited to be on the show, so I'm looking forward to it.
Well, good, good. Well, you were well-recommended by a previous guest we have, Chip, and so it's good to get the word out and share the knowledge, which is what we're all about here, is sharing knowledge. So, and we've got lots of questions tonight. Surely carp is, you know, now on the radar. You know, you could say 20 years ago maybe it wasn't, but certainly it has become a sport fish that all of us should know more about, and also a very challenging one. So, Paul, let's start out by just talking about the carp itself. You know, why should we fish for carp over other species we might have available to us?
You know, it's one of those fish that every time I go out, I can almost come up with a new reason. But, you know, every time that you go out and fish for these things, there's something new or something more exciting or something new that you discover, you know. First off, you know, they're so plentiful and they're so abundant and hardy. You know, they're big and they're strong. I mean, if you take the average carp that we catch on a day, say a 3, 4, 5 pounder, and you compare that to the average bass or trout that an angler may catch, I mean, there's just not much comparison. One of the other things that it offers is, you know, it gives you that sight fishing opportunity where, you know, it's you one-on-one with the fish that's feeding. You know, and you get that opportunity to present the fly to it, watch it eat the fly, and enjoy that whole hunting, you know, stalking, you know, challenge. And one of the other reasons, and one of the reasons I really got started was, you know, you can hone a lot of your skills as far as saltwater, you know, taking that bridge from the guy that's maybe he's only trout fished all his life, and he may be very good at that, and he may be one of the best, but when he's trying to make the bridge over to saltwater, you know, a lot of times carp offer an advantage where you can get out on the water, learn a lot of those different skills. So, you know, they enable, you know, anglers to, you know, just a whole wealth of knowledge, you know, to get out there and try some new things.
Well, certainly it it would improve one's casting skills, right? Or you would have to improve, I should say, to fish for carp.
It'll definitely improve because, you know, there's a little bit more to roll casting and drifting and mending. I mean, you know, you're going to be able to learn to, you know, to use that double haul. You know, you're going to learn to be able to, you know, pick out a fish that's moving, be able to communicate maybe with your guy that's on a platform behind you and, you know, take the instruction of, you know, there he is, 40 feet, moving left to right, got him, make that cast, make that presentation. You know, and a lot of those things need to become second nature in order to succeed. So, I mean, those things just take practice, and it's not something you can necessarily learn standing in the backyard on your ladder casting hula hoops. So, you know, you can go out up to the local lake and actually get some real-time practice. And that's one of the biggest advantages I think there is to fishing for carp.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, and, you know, I think when people first, at least some of the people I've talked to, when they first go out to fish for carp, and if they didn't maybe listen to a show like this beforehand, they'd assume that they'd probably be pretty easy to catch. But they aren't, are they? They're very challenging, much more challenging, I think, maybe than trout or bass.
You know, I think that they're probably one of the most challenging freshwater fish that any angler can target. I mean, whether it's because of their size or because of their senses or because of their intelligence. I mean, a lot of people think just because they live in areas where that may not be as pristine water as, say, the trout or the bass is living in, that they may be, inferior, but actually I think that they're showing that they're actually superior, you know, because they can handle, you know, lower oxygen concentrations. They can handle warmer water temperatures. They can handle polluted water. You know, they can handle all these things, which makes them actually a, you know, a more challenging quarry to go after, you know, I mean, because they're biologically adapted to be stronger and survive.
Right, right. There's a reason they're here. They're kind of an ancient fish, too, aren't they?
Yes, yes. They've been around for a long, long, long time.
And now, what type of carp are we talking about as far as sport fishing? There's different varieties,
well,
right? Different species?
There are two. There mainly, and I usually break it down to two varieties. I mean, you have your common carp, and you really have your grass carp. I mean, and under the designation of common carp, you have some other, I wouldn't say that they're subspecies, but you have some scale mutations, which you can find the leather carp and the mirror carp, which are more of a scale mutation than they are actually subspecies. And the carp are all members of the minnow family. I mean, you know, carp being one of the largest members of that family. And then you have the grass carp, which is a commonly known as the white amur, which was imported from Asia. And there's a lot of confusion between the two, and that's one of the biggest questions that I get a lot is, you know, I'll meet a guy at a show or doing a seminar, and he'll say, I have all these carp in my golf course pond, or I have all these carp in my grandfather's farm pond. You know, and right away I can't catch them, or, you know, this is going on. And a lot of times until they understand what they're fishing for, you know, they don't have much of a chance of catching them because there's a distinct difference between fishing for common carp as there is for fishing for grass carp.
Okay.
And I'm sure we'll get into that more. We'll get into that more and more. But, you know, but I mean, you know, that's one of the first things if you're going to take something away is to at least learn what fish you're fishing for because the techniques are definitely different.
Now, you had mentioned that grass carp came from Asia. Are carp native to the U.S., or were they imported at some time?
No, they really both started in Asia. The common carp was native to Asia originally, but it spread more to Europe during the Middle Ages, and then as it was brought to the United States more as a food source. And there's a lot of different stories of how it got here and who brought it here. But around the 1800s, whenever settlers were moving west, and it was brought in along the a lot of times along the railroad tracks. They were building the railroads. There was a lot of small ponds, and these carp were brought in as a food source. Because, one, it was very, very common in Europe as a food source, so it just naturally made that jump as it came to the United States. And eventually it gradually, you know, it kind of diminished as a food source. But like we mentioned earlier, with its ability to survive, it became very, very prolific. And, I mean, it just, you know, expanded, you know, its range expanded as, you know, it was just adaptable and, at one point, they were trying to eradicate it, but, you know, now, I mean, it's here to stay, and, I mean, it's not going to go anywhere.
Right. Now, in Europe, doesn't that fall under what they call coarse fishing or something?
Yes, or rough fishing. Yes, that's exactly
rough,
right.
Rough, yes, coarse, as opposed to the trout fishing, which is not coarse or rough, I guess.
Yeah, that's exactly. A lot of times, they're keeping the trout, and they're releasing the carp because they have a lot of respect for the carp there, and it's... You know, I have some guys that come from Georgia, you know, they just absolutely love to fish for them, and they will take them, they will harvest them. I mean, they enjoy them as a food source. I mean, you know, it's no longer a food source here for the United States, but, I mean, in Europe, it's still considered a, you know, delicacy in many parts.
Well, we have an upcoming show with Joel Stewart, and this is going to be an interesting show. I'm reading his book now. It's going to be on July 25th, and the title of the show is Fly Fishing Adventures in Baghdad. And this is about, he's a Navy officer that was stationed on Saddam Hussein's palace grounds where they had all these man-made lakes and stuff. And so he's got a lot to say about carp, which many of them are in there, and some relatives, I guess, of the carp, too, that were brought in and stocked there for trophy fish. So that'll be an interesting – these carp get everywhere, don't they?
They do. And they can survive anywhere. I mean, you know, it doesn't matter if they're in the desert or in the cold.
Yeah.
They're highly adaptable.
Yeah, I know down here in – you know, I live in Colorado, so down the Platte River in downtown Denver, Barry Reynolds is pulling trophy carp out of there all the time and going right through downtown Denver. So
yeah, well, I mean – they have the Carp Slam there now. I mean, they have a variety of different contests. I mean, it's become that popular. And just 10 years ago, I mean, you know, when I started out diving for carp, people were like, what are you doing? I mean, what's this? What's that? I mean, there was a few secular areas in the country where you had some guys that were doing it. And now it's just exploded. I mean, it's everywhere now, which is great. I mean, it's fantastic.
Well, how big do the carp get? And I guess we talk.
You know, I saw a note once, you know, I think that there was a world record that was 74 pounds was the biggest that I've seen. You know, with a lot of catch-release stuff, I'm sure that there's been bigger ones caught, but that's the one that is on record to date that I know of. But, you know, I mean, there's a lot of different areas in the country that do it. I know up on Lake Michigan at the famed Beaver Island up there, I mean, they catch them, you know, 30, 40 pounds. I mean, I know in the Susquehanna, I have a good friend that guides there that they catch them in the upper 20s and 30s, and, you know, he says that he's seen bigger. In my area here in the southeast, I mean, you know, we catch, you know, 20-pounders, you know, every year. So, I mean, they definitely get up into some big, big sizes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Brent, in Asheville, North Carolina, right around the corner from you, or just up the hill, I should say,
Yes.
He said, are rivers or lakes better for fly fishing for carp?
You know, I think that there's advantages and disadvantages to both. I mean, with a lake, I think that if you learn the local lake, and it may be big, it may be small, I think that you can easily pattern carp. I mean, and I think that you can predict the conditions that you're going to run into, whether that lake is a clear water lake or whether it's going to get muddy or what's going to happen to it after rain. Or, you know, your access is predictable. So, you know, that's one thing that a lake allows you to do. You know, but the downside of a lake is more than likely you're going to need a boat to get around. In a river, I think that, you know, you have some more variability. I think that in the river that the fish definitely tend to run bigger because I think that there are some larger protein sources and food sources for carp. You know, in a river, I think that you can also get out and wade, which gives you an advantage of having some more stealth. The downside of the river is, you know, rivers can get blown out. I mean, rivers can change. They can get unpredictable. There's a little bit more of a seasonal movement in rivers of carp. So, I mean, I think both offer distinct advantages and disadvantages. I tend to favor a lake. I mean, I think that it's just more predictable for me, and water conditions stay fairly stable. And as a guide, I mean, that's an important thing. You know, I think that that helps me quite a bit.
Right, right. And, you know, it is a totally different kind of fishing, you know, fishing from the front of a flats boat as opposed to, you know, wading in a stream. Two totally different experiences. Both of them, I'm sure, very rewarding no matter, you know, no matter what. So
I will add, though, on that note that, I mean, you know, we have a lot of smallmouth fishing. There's some of the biggest smallmouth taken every year are on the backside of carp in a river, you know, that the smallmouth has actually been, you know, kind of an opportunistic feeder. That carp's down there rooting around, kicking up all kinds of stuff, and you throw in that mud, and you get whacked really hard, and you catch the biggest smallmouth of the year because that smallmouth is up on that carp. You know, that happens more often than not. I mean, that scenario is one thing in a river that you just is, you know, well worth looking for.
Yes. Brent also asked about, is there a best time of year for carp?
You know, we're here in the southeast, you know, I've caught carp every month of the year. I mean, there are certain months that are certainly better, but, you could take example, I mean, you may have, you know, in the dead of winter, I have some power plant lakes, for example, and there's a particular flat or two that they could be snowing out and they could be generating power, and this flat can be, you know, extremely warm, and the carp will congregate right on that flat. So, I mean, that's just one of those things that, you know, that it can happen in the winter months. They'll start feeding. I mean, you know, you start getting water above 40 degrees, carp can become active, and you can find them. So just about every month of the year. But as far as the best times, you know, I particularly like the pre-spawn pattern, you know, which is, you know, you start getting water temperatures about 50, 55 degrees. You know, in my neck of the woods, I mean, you're talking about late February, early March. You get a lot of those big females that are coming up on the flats really starting to feed before the spawn. I think that's an excellent time to fish. And a lot of guys overlook it, you know, particularly this year. You know, we had such a warm spring. You know, it was February, and I had fish up on the flats. And we had, you know, I had some tried and true clients that I would call and say, hey, it's really on, and, you know, we just had a great, great pre-spawn period.
So that's, you know, the thing in the lakes, then, is you're looking for them to come out of the deeper water as the shallows warm up for them, right?
That's exactly right, because those mud flaps will warm, you know, they'll warm up a lot quicker. And those fish, you know, that's where their food sources are. They want to get up on there. You know, those mud flats will warm up, and they'll get up on there and start feeding as soon as they can, you know.
Okay.
And then, you know, as you get past that pre-spawn, you're going to start moving into that spawning period. You know, you start getting up around 65 degrees or so, you'll start starting to see fish that will spawn. That's a difficult time to catch fish. I mean, you still can do it, and I'm sure that question is going to come up along, you know, down the road, because that, it's just one of those periods where people get confused. And then after the spawn, as you move into the summer months, which is, you know, May, June, July, August, September, August, I mean, even as you get, you know, the dog days of summer, it gets really consistent. You know, the water temperatures will get up to, you know, upper 80s or 90. The carp's metabolism becomes very, very high. You know, it's a heavy feeder. It'll feed through most of the day, particularly in the morning and evening, and that's a really consistent time. And then you'll have another little surge in the fall, right before, you know, it's starting, you know, the first few cold fronts come in, and you'll get another surge then as well. So those, you know, one thing about carp, you can have a long, long season. So, you know, you can have a lot of different variables in there, but you can have a season of 6 or 8 months without even thinking about it.
Right, and it sounds like some in some areas where, in the shallower streams, when trout fishing gets a little dangerous for the fish,
right.
That you know, we can lay off those trout streams when they get too warm and go ahead for the carp, and yeah. And they'll probably be happy as a carp could be on a mudflat, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And you can catch a carp at 90 degrees; he'll give you everything he's got, and you'll release him, and he won't even pretend like he's tired. He'll give you a little splash with his tail as you let him go, and you know. He's good to go. I mean, you're not going to hurt him.
Yeah, very resilient. Okay. We need to take a quick break here, Paul, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Paul Rose more about cruising for carp. Our approach is simple, education. Fly Fusion is unique when it comes to fly fishing magazines. It is one of only a few magazines in North America that focuses on instruction and education. In Fly Fusion, they've covered subjects like short line nymphing, tactics for tough days, stillwater fly patterns, dry fly fishing for fussy trout, and a host of other interesting and educational topics. Visit their website today at www.flyfusionmag.com. That's www.flyfusionmag.com. And start your subscription today so that you can learn all you need to know about fly fishing. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Paul Rose about cruising for carp. If you'd like to ask Paul a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box there to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Paul, at this point in the show, I always ask my guests, you know, what's going on in their fly fishing world. So tell us what's going on in your fly fishing world.
Well, you know, CarolinaBonefish.com, we're having... You know, we're right in the midst of, you know, peak carp season right now, which is kind of what I'm known for. I certainly guide for, you know, for the trout, for the bass, the redfish, as I mentioned, but, you know, carp is what I'm known for, and that's what we embrace, and the season is in full swing. You know, and luckily where I live, I'm in an area where I'm able to guide for all that. I could take the same client for trout, for bass, for carp, for redfish. So, you know, they like that continuity. I got some great articles coming out and some major publications, mainly on carp fishing. You know, I'm offering some destination travel to Patagonia with Andy's Drifters. I mean, we got some trips coming up next year I'm excited about. And I'm working on a book, Carp on the Fly. So, I mean, a lot of this information I've been, you know, over the last 10 years, I'm trying to compile it and, you know, put it in one source. I think anglers will really enjoy that as well.
Is there any carp fishing down in Argentina?
Not that I know of. I mean, I like those big browns. I like those big browns on dry flies down there, though. I mean,
yeah. It's hard to beat those. But well, maybe you should look around when you're down there. Maybe that's a whole new.
I need to talk to Chip. I didn't even mention that. That's right. That river of monsters, though. He's got me so convinced of that. I think I may focus on that. But I'll need to look around.
Yeah. Hey, Argentine carp. I can see it now. Well, good. Well, thanks for sharing. What's your website address again? One more time.
My website is www.carolinabonefishing.com.
Okay, great, great. Well, let's see here. So I think you kind of talked about a few of these things, but let me just throw this out there one more time. What, for you, what makes carp so challenging for fly fishers? What are the major obstacles there?
I think that they're so challenging because I think a lot of anglers will start out by underestimating what they're going for. I mean, you know, carp have been around a long time, and most people, is when they were younger fishing in the carp ponds, catch them on billballs and night crawlers. You know, that's a lot of fun. I did that as a kid. I mean, I remember that. I mean, it's a great, great feeling to catch a big fish like that. But once you start taking the carp and, you know, putting them on a shallow water flat, you know, his senses are so great, and you have to do everything just perfect, that that's what makes it so challenging. I mean, because he can feel you, he can see you, he can smell you, you know, so he has all the advantages. And in order for you to even come close to getting him to eat, you've got to defeat all those senses first. And if you make one, they're very humbling. If you make a mistake, it's game over. And not only is it game over for that one fish, a lot of times these fish will, you know, they release a phenome or a stress hormone into the water. So if you spook that first one, you know, kind of his buddies that are around there, they're also gone. So, I mean, that's what makes it one of those things. Once you screw it up, I mean, you got to go to a new area, you know, and find a, you know, find a new spot.
Yeah, yeah. So you better get it right, huh? And and have a lot of spots to go to. How much time does it take for an area to recover from a scare like that?
You know, one thing, I think that if you catch one or you spook one, if you come back there at maybe 3-4 hours later, you'll find happy fish again. And, and that is actually something that you want to use to your advantage, because a lot of times when you go out for carp fishing, especially if you're new at this game, you want to go to your local lake or your local river, and the first time you go out, rather than fish, just leave the rod at home the first time. Go out, find some of these fish, spook them, see what they're doing, observe them, take your time, find out where they are, because once you do that, you can come back the next day or the next time you have the chance to get out. You can set up the day so that you can have success. You can find a certain point that you know holds carp or a certain back bay. You can take a look at what you're using for your approach, whether you're wading or whether you're using a canoe or a kayak or like me with a flats boat. You can say, I know there's going to be fish at point A. I got the sun mist. I can go there at 10 a.m. I'm going to have the sun behind me. I'll be able to see them. I know the wind's, you know, I have the wind going this way. That way you can set up your whole approach, and you can maximize everything to your advantage. And with that type of mentality, you have a lot more success.
We have a question here from Bill Henry in Brooklyn, New York. He says, why do people call carp a poor man's bonefish? I'm not poor, and I've spent some years fly fishing for carp in the New York City area. I've never been bonefishing and have no real desire to do so. I think it is a disservice to compare carp to bonefish. They may be similar in some respects, but I feel carp are unique, and there is no need to mention bonefish in the same breath when talking about carp. So what do
you...
Got some comments for
that's a good question. I like that question. I like that question a lot. You know, I had someone tell me once that a bonefish is nothing but a rich man's carp. So, I mean, you know, you could take a spin on that any way you want. But I think that what they're getting at there is for a poor man's, you know, for bonefish, usually more than often you have to travel somewhere. You're going to a lodge. You know, you may need some special gear. You know, for carp, you don't need any of that. So, I mean, there's not a whole lot of cost up front. You know, so, I mean, I'm like bonefish, and I guess that's probably, you know, it's the poor man's way of getting this fix for a bonefish flat, you know.
Right,
that's the
right.
Best I can figure there, which is very true because, you know, there's no doubt when you're fishing for carp, it is so close to fishing for bonefish or for redfish. I mean, the techniques are the same. A lot of the feeding patterns are the same. So even though that's kind of a joke, there's a lot of similarities between the three.
You fished for all three, bonefish, redfish, and carp. Which fish
Correct.
Do you think is the most challenging?
I think that,
given that wind conditions are all the same.
I think that catching a carp is more challenging than a redfish or a bonefish. Now, with that being said, if you take bonefish, they're really pressured, maybe down in the Keys or something, they may win that battle. But if if you're at a place where there's a lot of smaller bonefish, without a doubt, a carp is harder to catch. A redfish,
wow.
They can be finicky. They can be, bonefish can be tough. But day in, day out, a carp, you can do everything right, have the right fly, the right cast, and he's going to shun you more often than not. A lot of times with a bonefish or a redfish, if you do everything right, you're going to get rewarded. With a carp, you can do everything right 10 times in a row, and that carp is going to come up, look at that fly, and just turn away, and you'll be like, I can't do any better than that. Why did he eat that fly? I can't do any better than that. But eventually, you'll get one. But, they can definitely shut you down some days like that.
So it sounds like that, like you said, you consider carp fishing a training ground for going for saltwater species like redfish or bonefish or others. And it sounds like, if you could hone your skills there, then you've got your casting, your presentation, and all that figured out before you take a $5,000 trip down south,
Right. Because a lot of the glamour species, the bonefish, the redfish, the permit, all those fish require a lot of the same skills. You got to be able to see fish. You got to be able to present the fly. You got to be able to multitask. There he is, past 40 feet, moving right to left. All those things don't really change. So, when you go carp fishing, you can get 30, 40, on a good day, even 50 shots in a full day. You go permit fishing, you're not going to get that many shots. So you don't want it when you get that one or two really good shots at a permit. You want to have all your basics down so that you don't blow that shot doing something completely stupid that you've never, that you're just not used to doing. So that's one of the things that becomes second nature. If you do something 30 or 40 times in a row, you certainly get a lot better at it. You get a little muscle memory, things start clicking in your head. And it becomes second nature. And that's really what you need for a lot of saltwater fish is you need that, that instinct. Yes, boom, bang.
Yeah. It's not a place to be practicing your casting, right? You should have that all down and just make it intuitive and instinctive to present and so forth. But
that's exactly right.
Yeah, Rod in Portland, Oregon asks, what's the most important piece of advice you would share with someone who has never targeted a carp?
Well, if you've never targeted a carp, I would say that the best advice I would give you is to be patient, particularly with the learning curve. A lot of times, my first-time anglers, I'm up front with them. By the end of a full day, like we just mentioned, after you get 25 or 30 good shots, things will start coming together for you, and you'll start being able to put the pieces together that you need. And each time you make a mistake, whether it was standing on the line or not being able to see the fish, or maybe, making a presentation that was inaccurate, or maybe, bouncing your feet or moving the boat, or all those little things that continually can blow a shot for you. After you do each one of those, you'll get better and better and better. So it just requires a lot of patience, a lot of perseverance to succeed. So you just can't give up. It's very, very challenging. It's not a numbers game a lot of days, but it's, the end result is such a big reward.
Yeah, good. Well, let's talk about equipment for a little bit. Rod in Portland, Oregon, he said, let's see. Let's wait on Rod's question. Let's jump down here to Doug's question from Calgary, Alberta, Canada. He says, what rod weight typically do you use, and what fly lines do you prefer for carp fishing?
Well, as far as rod weight, I would say anywhere from a 6 to 8 weight is a good way to go. There are days when we can go a little bit lighter, and there are days when there's bigger fish around where we're going a little heavier, but a 6 weight to an 8 weight is probably an ideal setup. And as far as the rods go, or as far as the lines go, you want to taper. It's definitely going to be a weight-forward taper. Maybe say a redfish taper or some of the saltwater bonefish lines, because there's a lot of variability in the distances that you'll present flies to carp. You know, you may present to a carp that's 20 feet. On the next fish, he may be 40 feet. And then the next one may be back to 20. And then the next one may be 60. So there's a lot of variance in the distances you're casting. With those, you know, shorter, heavier tapers, I think that you can load that rod quickly at any of those distances and be able to feel it and be able to make accurate cast by limiting the number of false casts that you need. So I'm a big fan of those heavier, weight-forward tapers. And also, a lot of times, you know, those saltwater lines work really well because when you're carp fishing, a lot of times it is in the summer, and it is hot, and it is sticky and muggy. So, you know, those lines don't get gummy. I mean, they're made for the tropics, so where they don't get sticky, and you can really shoot some line because if you've been out and you have a cold water line and you take it somewhere where it's hot, that line gets so sticky it's almost impossible. You know, so there's some really good, you know, good lines out there designed for that. And I believe that Rio actually has a carp line, an actual dedicated carp line, and I've used it, and it works very, very well.
Mm-hmm. Maybe somebody out there in the audience tonight could look that up for us and shoot me a message if you can find it out on the net. That'd be good to know. And so back to Rod. Although we have another Rod question here from Ken Atkins in Granite City, Illinois, and he says he's got a Fluger 1195 automatic fly reel and that he uses for largemouth bass on his 8-weight. Will this be all right to use for fishing for carp? I'm concerned about the lack of backing on the carp run. So he doesn't have backing on that reel. Is that important for carp?
Yes. I mean, even on the smaller fish, even the 2-, 3-, 4-pounders, you know, a lot of times they will, that first run, they will take you to the backing. So this question comes up, I recommend at least 75, if not 100 yards of backing. I haven't used one of those automatic reels for a while. The only downside to that is, you know, they make really strong, powerful runs, particularly in the beginning and at the end. And if that drag and that reel is a little bit, you know, stutters and it's a little bit jumpy, that little bit of surge may cause that just to break off. You know what I mean? If you don't have good control, that hard jerk is what's going to break those fish off. So, you know, that would be the only downside to that automatic reel.
Right. So Rod in Portland, Oregon wants to know what your terminal tackle setup is. And do you tend to use weighted flies or weight your leader?
As far as the terminal tackle goes, I mean, I rarely throw less than a 12-foot leader unless I have an angler that just, you know, that's limited and can't turn that over. But I like a 12-foot leader to begin with. Mainly because, you know, carp will get a little curious sometimes. Even though they're, you know, they got all those senses, they'll see that fly line in the water. And sometimes that'll grab their attention. And they'll start following that fly line versus your fly. So, you know, having that 12-foot or even a 16-foot leader will eliminate that problem. As far as tippet goes, I tend to err on the lighter side because, I mean, carp, I mean, 8 to 10, maybe, you know, 2-3X, maybe 8 to 10-pound tippet, you know, which is 2-3X, is about the max that I use. If I got some really big ones around, you know, certain lakes, and I know there's some really monsters, 12 to 14-pound may be the max that I use. It just lets that fly move a little bit more, and I think if you get much heavier net, they see it, and they can kind of feel that. They're that sensitive to it. Almost, I must always use a floating line. As far as the flies goes, I don't ever remember weighting my leader with any split shot or anything like that. I vary my flies quite a bit. I'll either have unweighted flies, bead chain eyes, or lead eyes, or some flies that have lead wrapping, you know, right around the hook, because it's based on the depth that they're in. Because you want your fly to get down to their feeding level, but you also want it to land softly enough where you don't spook them, you know. And we'll get into more of the, you know, the feeding presentations that we're seeing, but.
It sounds like.
Go ahead.
Yeah, it sounds like like when you're fishing for bonefish, that you have the different weighted flies with eyes or larger eyes to get the sink rate the way you want it. So you have a similar challenge here. It sounds like.
Yes, I think the sink rate is probably, you know, and we'll talk about flies more, I'm sure, but I think the sink rate is probably one of the number one things that we need to consider in order to have success.
Martin Coleman in Lawrence, Kansas, he wants to know, he said, well, can you discuss some different rigging techniques for casting the carp on the shore, shallows, and open water? Sounds like you kind of rigged the same, but maybe change up the flies you're presenting. Is that the case?
Right. I mean, and a lot depends on conditions and the depth that they're feeding. I mean, we talked about if you have fish that are very, very shallow, you know, just a few, you know, backs out of the water, I mean, you're going to throw a fly that's unweighted because you want that sink rate down to the depth that he's feeding. But I also, you know, I don't fish for most of the carp that I'm fishing for are less than 3 feet deep. So, and the problem that you run into is when carp are feeding, they're pretty erratic, and you know, and they're, you know, they may stop and feed, and then they'll pick up and they'll move a few feet, stop and feed again, stop and feed, and you have to keep that in mind, because if you make a presentation and your fly is floating, you know, above them or not sinking fast enough, by the time it gets down to the depth, more than likely that carp has already moved on. You didn't spook him, but he's already fed one spot. Your fly's down to his level. He's already picked up and moved to the next spot. So you want to get your sink rates down so that that fly's, you know, getting into his zone while he's still in a feeding, you know, feeding mode. And a lot depends on the conditions. I mean, if you're fishing super clear water, you know, as far as your rigging, I mean, that's when you may need that long, long leader. I mean, but you also got to keep in mind, you know, your individual limitations. You know, if you can't turn over or cast, you know, a 16-foot leader, I mean, you know, you got to use what you can use until you get the skills. I mean, if I got guys that just can't turn over a 14-foot leader, well, I have to make certain adjustments, whether it's, you know, shortening that leader, getting him closer, or, you know, making certain adjustments so that we can have some success.
Well, thanks to Craig Owings in Moscow, Idaho. He went out and did a little Googling there and found out that Rio Products does have a carp-specific fly line. So you folks might want to check that out and see what they got. So maybe there's other manufacturers that are producing those now, too, as well. So thanks, Trek, for checking that out for us. Appreciate that. Thanks to you too, Duran. Looks like we got a couple people that helped us out with that. Well, let's talk. First I got to take a quick break, and then we'll come back and we'll talk with Paul more about cruising for carp. So, be right back at you. Women's fly fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's Fly Fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group-guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, Arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome, and equipment is provided. To learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net. www.womensflyfishing.net. Or you can call Pudge directly at 907-274-7113. That's 907-274-7113. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Paul Rose about cruising for carp. If you'd like to ask Paul a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Paul, let's talk about food and flies now. And I know you're going to have to maybe separate your answers here based upon common carp and grass carp, but what do they eat?
Well, as far as common carp go, I mean, they're opportunistic feeders. I mean, there's no better way to put that. They're omnivores. But with that being said, they can be extremely finicky some days, and they can be tuned in to one particular food source on any given day. So, I mean, yes, you could say they'll eat anything from worms to nymphs to crawfish, you know, leeches, terrestrial, midges, mayflies. But on a particular day, you know, they may be tuned in to a particular size or a particular pattern. And, you know, there's certain days where you just got to kind of figure that out. So, I mean, it's as easy as it is to say that carp will eat anything, Juan. Some days he's only going to eat a, you know, an 18 San Juan worm or, you know, a toy or something like that. I mean, so, I mean, it can be a real crapshoot. It definitely takes some experimentation.
But you can also selective. They get selective just like trout do.
That they can't, and that they will tune in. There'll be different, you know, hatches on lakes and, you know, in certain color of a crayfish or, you know, whether it's a green molting crayfish or, you know, whether it's particular, maybe they're in on worms that day or maybe there's, you know, some big hexes falling out of trees. I mean, I've run into more situations, but once you figure it out, I mean, that's when you can truly put some numbers in the book. Mm. And the ironic thing about carp, I mean, everybody knows a place where there's a restaurant or a place where the carp are more tuned into man-made things like dough balls and carp and corn and, you know, whether it's under the local diner on the lake that has a feeder there. Well, you think that's a gimme, but I've gone, you know, and gone to some of those places. It's not something that I routinely do, but I've gone there to check out, and those carp can actually be so tuned in to a certain food source, it's uncanny how difficult those fish can be because they're just that finicky.
Oh, you don't have a dough ball pattern?
Yeah, well, there are some, you know, right? I know there are some manufacturers out there that don't have popcorn flies, corn flies, dough ball flies. I mean, it's about anything you can think of. So they are definitely out there. So, I mean, that's what it takes. I mean, you know, those fish can be really tough to catch, though. You know, I remember one particular day, you know, in September in our area, the persimmons will start dropping off out of the trees. It's a fruit, you know, and, you know, they're about as big as a marble. And there's some trees that I would get under, and those things would be falling like small crab apples, and they would make a big plop on the surface, and those carp would just rush to that carp, or rush to that persimmons that would fall, and they would just devour it. So you would take flies and would do everything that you would think would be wrong for carp fish, and you'd make a big old plop of a fly, you know, a big wolf bug or something, and those carp would come over and kill it. And then there's like a week or two of the year that little pattern holds, but that's what they want. So, I mean, go figure.
What about the grass carp? Are they different?
Now, grass carp, I mean, you know, most people say that they're effectively vegetarian. I've seen them eat just, you know, different things. But as far as grass carp, I think that what's important there is, one, to recognize you're fishing for grass carp. And two, I think the grass carp are even tougher to catch than common carp. They are really, really spooky.
How do you tell the difference between them?
The easiest way is the coloration. You know, grass carp are very long, a little bit more slender. They don't have that shoulder redfish look to them. And the grass carp, the biggest way, they do not have those barbells like the common carp do on their mouth. Common carp are certainly more golden, but they also have, common carp have the barbells on their mouth. Grass carp do not.
Okay.
And with grass carp, the presentations are a little bit different. Grass carp, I think, when you want to catch a grass carp, you have to find carp in a feeding mode to begin with, regardless of which one you're fishing for. I've had the most success for grass carp when they're sipping off the surface, whether it's some sort of seed, some sort of plant matter, something that's floating on the surface where they're just kind of cruising along and their fins are out of the back of the water, they're real high in the water, and they're just sipping off the surface. And those are the fish that I target when I'm going for grass carp, because those are the ones that I think are the easiest. So in that situation, it's going to be an unweighted fly. It may be something like a woolly worm or some sort of a merger type pattern just under the surface, maybe some light-weighted bonefish flies. Grass carp also tend to be a little bit more tuned into brighter flies versus a common carp, which I'm using colors such as the drab olives and the burnt oranges. For grass carp, I'm typically using, you know, whites and silvers and yellows. So, you know, that just seems to work better for me, is to find grass carp that are feeding on the surface. And they can be a real challenge to catch, you know. So, I mean, and that question comes up a lot. So, but I recommend something that's just under the surface or on the surface.
Okay. Well, we did have a question on the internet about that. Randall in Akron, Ohio, wanted to know, will carp take a surface fly? So it sounds like grass carp will. Common carp will too?
Yes, there's a certain time of the year. I mean, depending on where you are, you know, there's a lot of guys in the country that say that I've never seen them on the top. I've never seen them on, the, you know, take dry flies. But here in the southeast, right around the middle of July through August, I mean, I have fish. They're not the biggest fish. They're anywhere from 3 to maybe 8 pounds, and they really tune in on terrestrials, and whether that's ants, beetles, crickets under trees. And usually I, you know, I'll stake it out. I'll be, you know, I have some areas and I know that, you know, big overhanging branches. And I'll see these fish. They'll just be cruising and waking under the surface, and you'll just see their lips coming up. And if you make a presentation that's fairly close to them, yeah, it's a pretty aggressive take, and it's actually a great way to catch a lot of fish. You know, you can, because the takes are pretty more aggressive than usual. And, for example, like a black beetle maybe is a good all-around fly for me on the surface. So I see that. I see it every year, and, you know, sometimes ants will work real well. I mean, that just goes back to what I was saying. You know, they just kind of tune in on a certain day, and if you could find them feeding on the surface, they're pretty easy to catch.
Question came in on the Internet, Danny Ward in Clarksville, and you kind of talked about to this already. He wants to know what color flies for carp are productive, and you said more natural colors for the common carp, right? And but you said brighter colors for the grass carp. What are there any particular colors that you like?
You know, for grass carp, I really like those the silver, the white, the yellows, and the chartreuse. It just seems to imitate more of a plant matter for me. And for common carp, in the spring is the only time I'll throw yellow. For some reason in the spring for common carp, that early pre-spawn period is the only time I'll throw a bright fly such as yellow. But for the most part, for common carp, it's almost always brown, olive, burnt orange, and if I had to pick one color, I would go with black as my number one color for common carp.
And let's see here. I think we have some other. Hold on. Oh, Treg wants to know if you ever use scents on your flies, either to mask your scent or as an attractant.
You know, I've never used it as an attractant. I mean, I just think that that is something, as a fly fisherman, it just doesn't work for me. I'm sure it would work because I've been to the stores where, you know, where they have the carp ponds, and there's a store, a local store. They must have had 100 different flavors for, you know, the, you know, who catches the biggest carp, you know, and they put money in and they catch them. So I personally, I don't use it. I think that it would work. I'm more concerned about scents such as maybe I gassed up the boat that day, or maybe I, you know, did something with the oil, or maybe I put suntan lotion and whatnot. I've done that on purpose where I put suntan lotion on my hands and touched a fly, and I've had absolutely, you know, look like they were going to eat that fly at the last minute, turn away, and just blow out of it. So there is no doubt that if you've got something noxious on your hands, it's going to be a downside. And if I'm running into that, and even though I don't have anything on my hands, you know, a lot of times I'll descent that fly by just dipping it in the water and getting some of the bottom and just rubbing it in that fly, getting some mud, getting some, you know, some debris on it. Something is on that fly that they don't like, and I've seen that make all the difference in the world.
Okay. A couple of questions on what flies you actually use here, one from Doug up in Calgary and Martin Coleman. And Martin Coleman has he wants to know what your five fly patterns you would always have in your box, but he's offered up some here, so let's see what you think of his selections, if you know of these. He's got Mike's Carp Candy, Black Bunny Leech, Brown Leech with Brass Cone Head, Number 8 Hare's Ear, and a Carp Carrot.
Yes, I know quite a few of those. I know Carp Candy, and I know the Carp Carrot. There's a great blog out. If you search a good blog, the Carp on the Fly and the Carp Carrot are great, all great patterns. You know, okay. I've used them, and they've worked. I think that each area of the country has some flies that would definitely work in their area more than they would for mine. The Hare's Ear, I mean, I don't think you could ever go wrong with that fly fishing for just about anything.
Right.
if I had to pick and my five flies that I would use, I would go with a, in no particular order, but I would go with a black woolly bugger. I would go with a Clouser swimming nymph. I would go with a Clouser foxy red. I would go with a Carter Nelson rubber leg dragon, and then I would go with something from Whitlock, maybe his near enough crayfish pattern. You know, and that, and the reason I'm picking those is because that gives me a wide range of flies, flies that are weighted, flies that are unweighted, and flies that imitate a lot of different food sources.
Okay, can you go over those again? Black woolly booger, Clouser
black
swimming
woolly nymph. Clouser swimming nymph,
right.
a foxy red Clouser, Carter Nelson's rubber leg dragon, which would do double duty as a good grass carp fly, particularly in its brighter colors. And then a Whitlock near enough crayfish pattern.
So you would tie that. What's the one you said for grass carp again?
It's called Carter Nelson's rubber leg dragon.
Okay, rubber leg dragon. Carter Nelson's rubber leg dragon. So that's one that you would tie in different colors. Is that one of the ones that's adaptable?
Yeah, because
it's
adaptable because you can tie it with legs. You can tie it in purples and chartreuses, but you can also tie it in blacks and browns. And it's just a good all-around. It's a real simple pattern, and it's just, you know, it has legs. It breathes real well. It has natural fibers. Has some marabou and some chenille, mm-hmm. and it's just a tried and true pattern for me that, you know,
right.
that I use all the time.
Great, great. We did get a question here from Nancy in Little Rock, Arkansas. She wants to know about plant flies. Have you had any luck with cottonseed flies or mulberry flies?
I have, and particularly for the grass carp. We talked about this a little bit, but the cottonwood seed from Rainey's, and that fly, it's designed in such a way that it floats, you know, just under the surface, and when you find grass carp that are feeding on the surface, which is what I key in on when I want to catch a grass carp, I think that's an excellent choice. Mulberry, you know, I know that in Florida and there's places where they have mulberries, when those hit the water, carp will key in on it, kind of like that persimmon berry that falls. So absolutely for grass carp, I think that it's a great way to go. There's some seed flies out there. There's some other plant flies. There was a really good fly that people talked about, Sister Mary's grass carp fly that a lot of people talk about. I've seen flies that were just, you know, just strands of grass, you know, because a lot of times for grass carp, you know, they'll be, you know, you can almost create a hatch where they're at the local golf course and they're doing some mowing and all those grass clippings are going into the water. And that'll really get grass carp going because, I mean, that's really what they like, that stuff floating on the surface. And you can actually tie flies that look like a little clump of grass that work very, very well. I mean, just a few, you know, strung out in the middle with a hook, and it works very well. You know, and the thing about, you know, a lot of it, and we'll get into, you know, the style of flies and, you know, what the characteristics of a fly, because even though I mentioned some of these and they all work very well, the presentation is really going to be key to fishing for carp. I mean, like for grass carp, for example, I mean, those flies that I mentioned, it's those are important flies, but you got to have that fly in the surface almost on a dead drift, you know. And then when we start talking about common carp, you know, there's certain characteristics of a fly that are going to make it more adaptable and more, you know, likely that fish is going to eat it if it's presented correctly.
All right. Well, a couple more questions on flies, and then we'll move on to strategies and tactics. And Daniel down – well, we're kind of moving that direction anyway here, but Daniel down in Arizona – he says he was asking about cottonseed flies too, but he says, well, this might be his best chance to catch larger fish fly fishing based upon where he lives and so forth. So he says, in the past, I've tried to catch them when they seem to be sipping through the surface like they are breathing, but refuse any fly that passes overhead. Are they breathing or are they feeding?
More than likely, I don't know his exact situation, but it could be common carp. More than likely, you know, hearing what he's saying, it could be grass carp. And they are so spooky that the best way or the best strategy I would tell him to do is get on your lake or wherever you are, stake out, and watch them, almost like you're in a deer stand, and wait till you get the perfect opportunity rather than just going out there and flailing at them and, you know, making a mistake and spooking them. Get out there, stay still, get low, you know, do everything stealthy, and watch those fish. And eventually one of them is going to give you the shot that you want, and then that's going to improve your odds quite a bit. Whether it's a fish that breaks away from the pack or that's really happy, he has no idea you're there, and then you can kind of dead drift one of those flies to him on the surface that we mentioned and improve your hookup. I mean, you may not get as many shots, but if you want to succeed in catching fish like that, that's probably what he needs to do.
Okay. Okay, great. Well, we need to take another quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk with Paul Moore about fly fishing for carp. So hang tight here, and we'll be right back. Have you ever dreamed about the classic actions of bamboo fly rods? Did you know that it's possible to make your own bamboo fly rods? With the help of Power Fibers online magazine, you can do just that. Power Fibers is a magazine dedicated to making bamboo fly rods and telling the stories about bamboo through the ages. From rod making techniques to stories about fishing bamboo rods to rod maker profiles to classic papers, Power Fibers has it all. Visit their website at www.powerfibers.com. That's www.powerfibers.com. We're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Paul Rose about cruising for carp. So if you'd like to ask Paul a question, just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, let's see here. We do have a bunch of questions piling up here online, Paul, so let me... And some of these are I've been saving for strategies and tactics here. Well, here's one, just kind of an odd one, but let's just look at this one. Dan in Laguna Niguel, looks like, he says, in rivers, will trout follow feeding carp similar to smallmouths? Also, during the carp spawn in rivers, will trout move behind the carp looking for eggs?
Couple things there. Yes, I think that fish, trout, smallmouth, catfish are another big one. They will all get behind feeding carp and take advantage of the things that, you know, that they're stirring up in that mud. Bluegill, crappie, I mean, I've caught just about everything on the backside of a carp. So I'm not so sure, you know, in the spawn, you know, when carp are spawning, I mean, it's really they're talking about, you know, a female with maybe 10 males on her, and it really gets to be just a bunch of confusion. So you don't, at that point, you don't necessarily see fish feeding on them because the carp actually aren't feeding at that point. They're just making a commotion, and you know, I don't often see fish waiting around when they're doing that because it's just too much commotion. Most fish are spooked by that. But when you get one or two carp that are feeding in the river and they're, you know, those muds are coming up. Yes, absolutely. That's just about any other fish in the river, you know, taking advantage of that situation.
That's more like a carp shuffle, like the San Juan shuffle. But I think he was talking more about the spawn, the eggs from the carp. Is there any?
No, I don't often see that. I can't say that I've seen fish keyed in on those eggs. I'm sure after the spawn, because those eggs are going to drift, and I believe they attach to vegetation. But I can't say that I've seen fish keying in on the eggs, because unlike a bass, there's no particular bed made by carp. Unlike bass or bluegill that are making a bed and the eggs are right there where fish come in and key in on those eggs. On carp, I mean, they're back in a shallow and there's usually vegetation around and those eggs are just free drifting. There's no actual bed. The fish are going crazy, you know, and there's no bed, so the eggs are just kind of dispersed pretty quickly. So I can't say that I've seen selective feeding on carp eggs.
And Craig wanted also to know about whether you stop fishing during the spawn.
No. I mean, the spawn is the least, you know, is a hard time to fish, but not all carp spawn at the same time. So what I'll do is, when you see spawning fish, I mean, and you can't miss them. They're not feeding. A lot of people get confused and they'll beat the water and try to catch those fish. The fish that are actually spawning are not going to eat. I mean, they got other things to do, other things on their mind. But if you back off spawning fish, there's always some, you know, really some pre-spawn fish. They're kind of lurking. And if you back off the spawning fish, you'll see fish moving in and out of those flats to feed and, the, you know, that are pre-spawn or even post-spawn. Those are the ones you want to target, you know, because they will eat and they can be pretty aggressive at that time. And you can catch a lot of big females that aren't quite ready to spawn yet. They're just kind of moving up or, you know, or so, I mean, I don't throw at spawning fish, but there's always other fish around that are lurking on the outside of those edges that are well worth fishing for.
Okay. Travis in Boise, Idaho, wants to know, what types of water, dirty versus clear, do carp find themselves more apt to be in? The water conditions, water color, or daylight conditions change where the fish find themselves throughout the day?
You know, for me, you know, I think that carp are in all types of water. I mean, they're going to go where the food source is. But for anglers, I don't think that there's any doubt that clear water is going to be a key to you catching them. And there's a couple different reasons for that. Because if you can see the fish, you can see the fly, and you can see his reaction all at the same time, your odds are going to go way up as far as your success of catching one of these fish. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you don't often feel a carp take your fly. You're more than likely you're going to see it. Even a big fish, you just don't, the takes are subtle, and they can spit that fly so quickly that, you know, you'll make a presentation, you'll watch that carp, you'll see what your fly is doing, and you'll see his reaction. So a lot of times in clear water, you'll see that fish actually eat your fly, and you'll never feel it. So if you weren't able to see it and you were in muddy water, you'd have no idea that you had a hit. So I am a big advocate. I do not fish stained water if I can help it.
Okay. On the Internet here, Danny from California wrote in. He wants to explore some local waters for carp. What do I look for in a lake, pond, or river? Ideally, can they be seen? Where should he start? So it sounds like he's just wondering whether it's carp water or not.
There aren't many lakes that don't have some sort of carp in them. So, I mean, more than likely they're there. And we talked earlier, you know, take a day and just really get out there and explore and spook some fish. That way you'll know they're there. Take note of where they are, and then you can come back at a later date. But areas that are typically going to be pretty common for you on any lake, you know, any point, the flanks of a point, particularly a point that's a riprap point, is almost always going to have carp on it. If you've got an island is always a great area to start because, you know, there's a lot of overhanging branches, you know, usually has deep water, you know, with a shallow water flat around that island. So islands are always another area that are worth checking out. You know, any back bay or any flat or any feeder creeks that are coming in, those are all areas that if there are carp there, they're going to be found in, you know, areas such as that.
Where do you look for them in rivers or streams?
In rivers and streams.
Hold like trout or bass?
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of guys will say that you'll see them in the faster waters, but I particularly prefer them, you know, in the back eddies, in the slower pools, or, you know, anywhere where the water is a little bit slower where I can find them. The same thing, tailing, mudding, you know, where I can see them. It's kind of like, you know, when you're floating down the river and you're really hitting that one bank for smallmouth, you know, that's a great area to fish. But if you look on the other side of the bank, I mean, that's usually the slower side, and that's typically where you're going to find those carp. And there's little, you know, you can still find islands on rivers, and you can still find back eddies, and you can find, you know, areas, you know, little coves and stuff where the water's just a little bit slower. Stuff that fish aren't holding everywhere, those are the areas that I target because that's typically where I find fish that are feeding, you know, and I can't stress that enough. If carp are feeding, you can catch them. If they're cruising or they're doing other things, they're just hanging out or whatever else, you know, if they're not feeding, they're almost impossible to catch for me.
Are there any, like, telltale signs that carp are in the area that you can see in the water other than the fish?
Particularly in a lake, I mean, you know, if you go into a back bay, you can see areas of pock marks on the bottom. you know, where you'll see hundreds and hundreds of little imitations in the back bay, where you can tell where those carp have been, where they've been rooting and mudding and tailing, and it leaves a little impression, a little indentation in the bottom. And almost, you know, those are carp that are doing that. And it's just a matter of you getting there at the right time, or maybe you already spooked them out. And, you know, you're going to start seeing, as you get more and more tuned into your lake, you'll start seeing muds, you know. And muds are probably the most important thing when it comes to carp fishing, because that's a sign that there's a feeding carp close by.
When you say muds, what do you mean muds?
A mud is, you know, when a carp feeds, you know, he's usually on the bottom. I mean, we talked about him being on the surface, but more often than not, he's going to be feeding on the bottom, and he's going to be rooting. And as he's rooting and filter feeding, he's going to stir up mud from the bottom. And that's what, you know, and you can see those. If you're in a clear lake, a lot of times you can see those muds from, you know, 50 yards off. You're just going to see an area that's cloudy. And it's just from something stirring up the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see that on saltwater flats, too. I mean, you can be down in, you know, down in the Marquesas. I mean, and the water's crystal clear, but you'll be pulling along, and you'll see a huge area that's mudded. I mean, it could be from bonefish. It could be a ray. It could be redfish. It could be a permit. I mean, it has to be something that's causing that. And so once you see that, you know, you plan your approach like we talked about. You know there's a feeding fish somewhere close by. So all that does is it tunes you into slowing down, not making any noise, kind of getting set up, kind of getting ready. It kind of gives you an alarm system where saying, okay, I'm in the right area. These fish are mudding, and I can, you know, there's feeding fish close by. And then when you start looking at these muds, I mean, you can tell so much from it. If the mud's, you know, maybe the mud's really tight and compact, well, you know that that's probably an active mud, and there's probably a fish in that mud. But if you see a mud that's kind of dispersing and an area's kind of looking kind of foggy and, you know, kind of dispersed, you know that's an old mud. You can also tell, you know, from the direction that mud's, you can tell the direction of the fish that's traveling. I mean, you know, if mud's blowing from left to right because of the wind and the current, well, you can tell the direction of your fish. And as the muds, as you get closer to the fish, the muds are going to become more and more compact, and eventually you're going to see the fish in one of those muds, and then you can make your presentation.
Mm-hmm.
And a mudding fish is probably the easiest carp to catch.
Okay, good,
he's good. Actively feeding, and that's going to be the thing you want to key in on.
Now, I'm sure your answer is going to be different for lakes versus rivers here, but do you ever blind cast for carp? Or are you always sight fishing?
I am almost 90% I'm sight fishing.
Okay.
10% of the time, I may find some really large muds that are so large, and I may be seeing a flick of a tail of a large fish in there. And once I determine his direction, I'll place some flies in there. And at that point, you know, since you can't see that take, you're kind of watching the tip of that fly line for any motion at all. Because regardless, when you make a cast for a carp, you know, you want to get that rod tip down. You don't want to have any slack in that line whatsoever, because the take is going to be very subtle. It's going to be pretty quick, so that once you see the fish eat that fly, or if you see the end of that fly line leader junction jump forward, you want to be able to strip strike. And a strip strike is just more of a quick pull on the line to set the hook versus lifting. You know, if you lift when a carp takes it, the way he's designed, and if he's on the bottom, a lot of times you're going to pull the fly right out of his mouth. You know, for trout, and a lot of trout guys have that habit, you know, where they're nymph fishing and they're lifting that rod up to set the hook. If you do that carp fishing, you're going to miss a lot of strikes. So instead, that rod is straight down, and you have a straight line from the tip of the fly, from the end of the fly rod, down the fly line, down a leader to the fly, so that you can have just a quick pull, and you're moving that fly and setting the hook.
Yeah, a couple of shares here on the Internet that people have sent in here. Danny in Clarksville says there is a fly called the breadcrest fly and also one called the mulberry fly. So those do exist. And also... Let's see here. Phil Panko said he talked to Brad Beefus, who's a big carp fisherman out west here, and now he's in Wisconsin. He says he purchased a yellow toilet sponge from a store once and cut it up and then painted them with a marker to make it look like breadcrumbs.
Well, innovative fire there, you know.
Let's see here. Phil has a good question here, Phil Panko in Rochester, Minnesota. And Phil, he says, what tactics or methods do you use in targeting carp? Do you target fishing fish coming and going from the pod, or fish in the pod? So I think he's, you know, like when you think about tarpon, you see a pod of fish coming in. Do you have that same kind of action, or are they all usually independent fish that you're fishing to? And would you fish to them on the edge of a, if there are multiples, are you fishing the edge first?
Typically when I see pods of fish, you may see some pods feeding on the surface, but typically podding fish are fish that are either cruising or, you know, or moving into a spawning area or something along those lines. I tend to observe those fish, not necessarily cast to them, because more often than not, I tend to spook those fish. And if I spook those, they kind of blow out a flap for me. So a lot of times I'll let pods of fish go by. Unless they're actively sipping on the surface, I usually let them go by, watch them, and more often than not, one or two of those fish are going to break off and start tailing or mudding. And those are the fish that I focus on to have the most success. Once they start tailing or once they start mudding, those are the fish that I know I can catch.
Now, we have a question from Robert, Nevada. He says, fly fishing for carp on the flats is ideal and reminds me of bone fishing. However, sometimes there are no good flats. How do you approach fly fishing for carp in lakes when they are abundant but there are no good flats?
It's kind of a misnomer. Now, we talk about flats on a lake. Now, I've been bone fishing enough times where most lakes, you're not going to have flats that are, you know, hundreds of yards wide and long and clear, because that's just not the way a lake is. Well, I'm talking about a flat. I'm talking about more of a water depth of, you know, somewhere between that 1 and 3 feet. And a lot of times that may only be me following a shoreline contour, for example. I mean, I may be in 15 feet of water and be following down the shoreline contour where there's a flat that extends out from the shore maybe 5 feet out, that's sandy, has some riprap on it. So that's really the flat that I'm following. You can also find flats in the backs of bays. You know, once you go into maybe a large creek, has some secondary creeks in it, some secondary points, you know, as you follow those back, become more and more shallow, and I actually create flats. The flats, I mean, they'd be more micro flats as compared to a bonefish flat that's maybe just hundreds of acres wide. And a lot of times I'll have on a particular lake, I may have 50 or 60 little micro flats that I can go and fix. And, I mean, I have it on the GPS. I mean, I'll just go into one area, and you got to, like I said, set up the bay where, you know, turn off that big engine early, use the trolling motor, you know, to get close, and then maybe either dead drift onto that little micro flat, or maybe, you know, for me, I like to pull a lot, you know, where you can pull onto that flat, and you may only get one shot at one fish on that micro flat, but it's going to be a good shot. You catch him, you blow it, you screw it up, I mean, you miss him, but then you go to the next micro flat. And by the end of the day, if you've gone to 40 of those places, I mean, you're averaging, you know, you're getting 25 or 30 really good shots. So there's certainly an advantage to having, you know, mobility, you know.
If you're sight fishing, you're not going to be fishing to a fish in 10 feet of water, right? I mean, these areas that you can access the fish.
And you have a lot of them, and you just, you know, you go to one, and you go to the next one, you go to the next one.
Yeah.
And luckily, there's still not a lot of pressure out there. You're the only guy a lot of times, even on a busy holiday weekend at a very popular lake. Those places aren't frequented by jet skiers and pleasure boaters and, you know, water skiers because they're just too shallow. So don't be afraid to get out there on July 4th because there's nobody else back there in, you know, 1 foot of water. So, I mean, the carp is there. Nobody else is there.
We're running out of time here fast, and but I still have a few questions. I want to try to knock these out, so maybe you can kind of keep your answers short here, Paul. Tim in Chattanooga has a good question, I think. He says, how close to the fish do I need to present my fly when they have their head down rummaging through the dirt? It seems they are so focused on that one spot that you would basically have to hit them with the fly before they notice. So you got to...
If you have a fish like that, I would consider that a tailing fish, which is a real vertical presentation. And yes, you want to get that fly almost on a dinner plate presentation, right in front of his nose.
Okay. Okay. There was a couple questions. One offline, Steve in New York, and then one that just came in on the internet, Bill Henry in Brooklyn. Both of them are asking about fishing for koi. Have you ever fished for koi? Are they similar to carp? I think they're probably in the same family, I would expect. But
yeah, koi is a, I believe they're classified as a domesticated common carp. And I've seen them on around some of the restaurants. I mean, that's usually where I run into them. I've targeted them a few times with the same flies I have as common carp. I've caught a few, but I just don't get that many shots at them.
Yeah.
So I don't have, I just don't see that many of them in the lake.
So try your carp tactics on them and see what works, right?
Yep, that's exactly right.
Yeah. John in Leawood, Kansas says, I fish a small lake in Kansas, and the carp there are very cautious and wary of anglers. Sounds familiar, right? I have casted a number of flies their way and have only one take in many, many casts. Any suggestions on presentation or the fly?
I would make sure that you're learning to read that water and learn when to cast. Make sure you're not casting and spooking fish, but rather being patient, waiting, staking it out, observing, and then making the cast and the presentation to the fish that's feeding and happy. You know, don't just start flailing away. Just be patient, wait for your shot, and it'll happen for you.
Okay. I think we've about handled it here. One final thing to close the show out here. Once you've hooked up with a carp, got any tips on fighting and bringing that carp in? Anything different than other fish?
Well, you know, it starts with that strip stripe. So once you get him on, once you set that hook, that initial surge is the only time I want you to look down, because that's when that line is going to be wrapped on it, or you're going to be on a motor or on the pole or on your feet or whatever it may be. So as soon as you strip strike, look down, clear the line, get him on the reel. Once he's on the reel, you know, that's when you want to use the butt of the rod, because, I mean, maybe you're using your 6-weight, but if you're into a 15-pound fish and you're fighting him incorrectly, you can easily break a rod with these fish. Most fish are lost during that first run, and then most fish are lost right before you're ready to land that fish. You think that a carp is done. He always, always, always gives you one last head shake and one last dive down below the boat. So that would be the next time. You know, there's a good chance you'll lose him either in the very beginning or the very end. Just make sure you use a low side angle, trying to turn that fish's head, you know, back towards you.
Sounds like the down and dirty method that you use in saltwater fishing is the way to go then. Low rod angle and try to turn their head on the side, right?
Precisely.
Yeah, okay, good. Well, Paul, we've run out of time here, and we need to wrap things up here, and we've got a few prizes to give away and so forth. So stick with me for a few more minutes. I'll need your expertise here when we do our contest here. So stick with me for a few more minutes, and then we'll close things up, okay?
Okay.
So we will be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers here in a few minutes, and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine, and also that $20 gift certificate for Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado. So stick with me here, and we'll do just that in another minute or so. A mining company called Pac Rim Coal is planning a massive strip mine up near Anchorage, Alaska, and the Chewitna Coal Project as it's called, would be the first project in Alaskan history to mine directly through salmon habitat. The Tweetna River drainage, is 11 miles of critical commercial, sport, and subsistence fishing economies that would be permanently destroyed. PACRIM says they can rebuild the salmon stream, but scientific experts can find no example where successful restoration has occurred after strip mining. A Tweetna coal would be shipped to Asia, leaving Alaska with nothing but devastated habitat and ruined salmon runs. It's time to stop the Tweetna coal strip mine, and if you'd like to help do that, you can get more information at www.inletkeeper.org. That's www.inletkeeper.org, or you can go to trustees.org, Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on the link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away our prizes, and the winners for these drawings are randomly selected from our show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late, but make sure you do so for our next show so that you don't miss out on all of these great prizes that we have to give away. So, if you do win, we'll contact you after the show and get the information we need from you to so that you can receive your gift. The first thing we're going to give away here is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And to learn more about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. You can learn all about them. It's a great organization to be part of. And our winner there is Greg Munier in Indiana. So congratulations, Greg. I know you'll enjoy your membership, and if you do have one, we'll get that extended for you as well. Now, we'll give away a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine, and it's a magazine out of Calgary, Canada. And if you want to know more about that or get a subscription, go to flyfusionmag.com. And our winner there is Dennis Voss, in Oklahoma. So congratulations, Dennis. And I'm sure you're going to enjoy that great magazine, Fly Fusion magazine. Now, Paul, we're going to pose a question out there to our group, those listening live, and we'll see who's going to be our winner of our $20 gift certificate. Let's see, I'm clearing my queue here. Okay, we're set to go there. So the question is going to be, in the spring, sometimes Paul will, this is a two-part question, okay, In the spring, sometimes Paul will use a particular color, and that's the only time he uses that color for common carp. Also, that's part one of the question. And the other part of the question is, what's a common length leader that Paul likes to work with in most situations? How many feet? So, Paul, is that clear enough, do you think?
I have, yes. I think that's a great question.
Okay, so that's a two-part question. Got to get both parts right to win. We got our first answer here. He says, natural, like brown or black, and bright yellow in the spring. Well, that answers the yellow in the spring answered part of the question, right? But
yes,
he didn't get
correct.
The part about the leader. I think he probably sent it in too quick. So, well, this one says 14-foot and yellow in the spring. I don't think so. Do you, Paul?
No, we're off a little on the length there.
Yeah. Well, here we go. I think we got one yellow for common carp and 12-foot leader.
Yes, that is correct. That is the winner.
That winner is Treg Owens.
Yeah.
I think Treg won last show or the show before that. So he's, he was a little late on this one, but he was the first one with the right answer. So it pays to be careful, doesn't it? So, Treg, hey, another winner for you, bud, and thanks for contributing because he always contributes on the show. And I really appreciate his questions and so forth. So congratulations, Treg. Got your email address here. We'll get you set up for that $20 gift certificate with frontrangeanglers.com, frontrangeanglers.com in Boulder, Colorado. Thanks to them for providing the prize. Well, thank you, Paul, for being on the show tonight. We really appreciate you being with us and taking time out of your busy carp season, and we'll let you get back to fishing, but thanks so much for being with us.
And thank you, Roger. It was a great opportunity, and if any of the listeners have any questions whatsoever about their particular scenario, just have them email me, and I'll help them any way I can.
Okay, and they can get your email address on your website or a form to fill out.
Yes, you can get me at through CarolinaBoneFishing.com, and I'll be glad to help them with any problems or anything I can do.
Okay, great. Well, one more thing, folks. Hopefully you found the archive on our website. If you haven't been there, there's a couple of links you can get to it from, both on our homepage and at the bottom of each page says archive. And there you'll find all our past shows, over 145 shows now we've got in our archive. Once you get to the archive, you can search by a keyword or keyword phrase like trout, tarpon, Madison River, whatever, and then you'll find all the shows we've done that meet that criteria. So give it a try. Go ahead and explore. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised at what you'll discover out there. Our next broadcast is going to be on June 20th, 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, we're going to interview Rob Provost, and our topic for the show will be bonefish in Hawaii. Rob was one of the very first people to introduce locals and business vacation travelers alike to pursue Hawaiian bonefish on the fly. So listen in to learn about fly fishing for bonefish and how it differs from other places in the world. We'd also like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska, and Power Fires Online Magazine for sponsoring our show tonight. Think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at www.askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing the Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.